It's January 12th, 2024. This is Debbie Goldman. I'm interviewing Annie Hill in Washington, D.C. So, Annie, let's start at the beginning. When were you born and where?
I was born on October 1st, 1953, in Roseburg, Oregon.
Okay. And you went to school in Roseburg, Oregon?
The town I grew up in was Sutherland, which was right close to Roseburg. Sutherland didn't have a hospital, so that's where I grew up and spent all my time there until I graduated from high school.
Do you want to talk about any of your early experiences as a kid and how that might have affected you in terms of your later life and your values?
I think probably the biggest thing as far as what I ended up doing, which was different than what I planned to do, was that my dad was a Teamster. And so he delivered milk first door to door when they did home delivery, and then eventually they eliminated that service and then he did wholesale delivery. I don't remember him being an activist per se, or what we would think of as an activist today, but I do remember being aware that he was a union member and that that was very important. So when I did end up going to work for the phone company, that wasn't a question in my mind of whether or not I would be a union member.
And your mom?
My mom was pretty much a stay-at-home mom, and she had a few side jobs. She wrote for the local newspaper, and she worked in a dress shop, but she was stayed at home. And then she had gotten ill when I was about 9 or 10, so then she didn't work at all out of the home after that.
And you have one sibling?
I have one sister, a younger sister. Her name's Lindy, and we're close, and she lives in Oregon still.
And you grew up in a small town? And how far was that from a big town? Was it in eastern, western, central Oregon?
It was in what was called the Willamette Valley. The town was 2,500 people, so a very small. Portland, which I think probably, especially people on the East Coast, would be the only town in Oregon that they would think of as big, was about 3.5 hours away.
And after high school, did you go to college or start working?
I went to Oregon State University, and then while I was there, my second year, I got hired as a summer hire at the telephone company and worked in Roseburg for when I was on holidays and off on summers.
This was which company?
Pacific Northwest Bell.
And what year?
That would have been, I started college in 1971, and I was there between 71 and 75.
And what did you do?
At the phone company?
Yep.
While I was working for 3 of the summers, I worked inside as a repair service clerk. And so I posted service orders, I took repair calls. It's back before they consolidated everything, so we had, it was pretty much one-stop shopping. There was test board and assignment and service reps down the hall and still operators that were also down the hall.
You were in the central office then and all that was?
Yes, the central. There was a central office there, yes.
And did you complete college in 4 years?
I did not. I have not yet to graduate. I am just short of graduating. And then when I was short a few credits, and I ended up getting called. I was going to go to summer school, and I got called by the phone company, and they offered me a job as an outside technician. This was in 75, 76. They had just started hiring women in outside jobs, and so I decided to do that. The plan was I would work for the summer and then go back to school in the fall. Well, I kept working, and they offered me a full-time job, and I took it and moved to a different town. So I ended up not going back to college.
I think I asked you, but I forgot that I asked you. Which company?
Pacific Northwest Bell.
Thanks. Okay, so this was 1973 was the EEOC consent decree, mm-hmm. and a couple years later, Pacific Northwest Bell was looking to have more women in the technician job,
yes.
and they saw you, and they picked you. So what was your job?
So when I first started out, I was a regular residential installer. The summer that I started out, I did a lot of, we did a lot of pre-wiring then. Of course, that was way before cell phones, and the goal was that everyone would have three or four phones in their home, landlines, as we now call them. So a lot of, and everything was wired back then. So I did a lot of pre-wiring of new construction, and then eventually got trained on doing the installation side of it and a little bit of repair.
So pre-wiring means what?
So as a home or business is going up, so while there before there's drywall up and there's just studs, you would go in there just like an electrician would, and but you would run telephone wire, not electrical wire.
And so this was, you would do physically wiring the,
you
the
would
home.
Drill the holes and run the wire and make sure it was everywhere it was supposed to be.
And what was your job title?
I think it was, it changed several times over the course of several years. I think it was service technician.
Okay, and if it changed, what were other titles that?
I don't remember.
Okay, but that was the outside plant
yes.
work.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And talk about your training. How did you get trained to do all these things?
So when I first started, it was on-the-job training and learning from other people. When I got hired full-time, then they sent me to school to learn how to climb and the regular installation and repair school that they would send you to. So I remember it was 4 or 5 weeks. And I ended up doing that particular job for about 3 years. And then I had an opportunity to move and do business installation.
When you started and you were in your training class, were there any other women?
I don't recall if there were other women in my training class. This was still early on in getting women into those positions. When I was working, when I ended up where I was permanently hired, which was in Medford, there was one other woman that was working outside, so it was just the two of us.
And how many men in the, out of that?
40, maybe.
Okay. And how'd the guys treat you?
Overall, very well. The other woman seemed to have more problems, was my observation. Of course, I was young then, only in my mid-20s. But I just found a lot of it was the attitude that you had, and that you didn't go in as a know-it-all, and you would ask for help if you need it. You would be willing to commit and do the job. And I think one of the reasons the other woman had a problem was that she was often asked for help, and when someone would show up, she would always ask them to do the harder part of the job. And so I think they tended not to respect her as much.
Did you like the job?
I did. I liked it a lot.
What did you like about it?
You were outside. There was a lot of freedom. You got to meet a lot of people. Of course, back then, there was... Being a woman outside was very new, so the reaction from the customers was always pretty unique from, you know, they being surprised and happy to see you versus they might be a little unsure that you really knew what you were doing. I remember some people, they would sort of, you know, follow you around and make sure that you looked like you knew what you were doing.
Talk about the freedom.
So it's just different being outside in a truck and having a load of orders versus being at a desk. So it's just a very different kind of environment. Of course, that was before a lot of the monitoring that is in place nowadays. So there wasn't so much focus on that. There was focus on getting the work done and getting the work done well.
In other words, they weren't tracking where there was no technology to
no.
track where you were or when you took your lunch or other kinds of things.
No,
like
other
that.
Than calling in when you were done with each of your orders or repair job, no.
And then when you went to business installation, this would, how did that differ?
So first it was unique in how I got there. I only got the job because I was a woman. And so it was another EEO override into the position. There was a lot of men that were more qualified than me, that had a lot more seniority than me, that got bypassed. And I struggled with that a bit. I mean, it bothered me a little bit, but I knew that eventually how I came to terms with it is I knew if it wasn't me, it wasn't going to be one of the guys. It was going to be another woman because they were looking for a woman in that position. Because a lot of people aspired to do that kind of work. When you were doing business, the work was more technically difficult because of the equipment, different equipment that you would work on. But the environment that you tended to work in was more often than not inside. You weren't out in the elements, in the rain, in the cold. You weren't out there in your rain gear every day. So a lot of people aspired, and you got to learn a lot more. So there was a lot of training involved.
Was this a higher title?
Yes. Yes.
What was that?
It was a PBX installer.
Uh-huh. Explain what a PBX is.
So that's what the business systems used to be called. They were almost like mini central offices. So it was before electronics. Some of the electronic switching systems started to come in as I was getting at the end of that. More towards divestiture when I changed jobs again. That's just what they called it back then. I'm sure it's an acronym, but I don't remember what it stands for.
But in essence, it's a switch that's put at a business place. And then in the old days, when if you were in an office and there would be many extensions, rather than that being coming out of the central office, it would be at the place of business.
Correct.
So you were all this time doing installation and repair, or just installation?
When I was doing residential, I did primarily installation, but did do some repair. When I did the business or PBX, I primarily did installation.
So you weren't climbing poles outside?
Sometimes if it was a smaller business and the terminal was at the pole, you'd have to run a drop or to get dial tone in there. But probably more often than not, the cable was actually in a terminal room in the building.
So you weren't up there on the pole repairing cable. That was a different job.
I had that job after divestiture.
Okay, so this is a long time, so jump ahead to that.
So when divestiture happened.
1984.
AT&T split off from the Bell system, and technicians were given an opportunity to make a preference on where they wanted to go, either from the business side, and I had chosen or opted to stay with go with AT&T, but I was very low on seniority, and so I ended up staying with the operating company, and ended up in that. What they did is they placed us in cable maintenance.
Why had you wanted to go to AT&T, and do you think ultimately it was a lucky chance for you that you didn't go to AT&T?
I wanted to go with AT&T because I really liked the work that I did and wanted to continue to do the work.
The business installation
versus learning a whole new sort of trade of cable maintenance. It was absolutely very, very lucky because it wasn't unique where I was working, but very quickly AT&T started to right-size, downsize, lay people off, and I was lowest on the seniority pole, which is how I ended up back with the operating company to start with. So I would have been one of the first ones out the door if I had been with AT&T.
And what company was it now? Same company?
U.S. West.
So at that point, the Northwest Pacific Bell, and which ones?
Northwestern Bell, Mountain Bell, and Pacific Northwest Bell were put together and became U.S. West.
We'll jump. I'm just jumping ahead a little, but they were separate contracts for a little time, or no?
Yes, they were separate contracts until we started to combine them in 1989.
Okay. And you stayed then as a cable. So what did you do as a cable maintenance? Was this a different title?
I don't remember specifically
you
what
had
the title.
Lot of
I had
jobs.
A lot. I had a lot of different jobs. Yes. So by then I had. So this was 1984. I had gotten involved with the local union. I was the secretary in our local union, and so I had some time off from there. So the cable maintenance was a whole different ballgame. It was more on the construction side, so you were working on the cable facilities that came up to a terminal that then fed a house or a business. So sort of a whole different ballgame, a whole different skill set. I don't remember I think a lot of it was on the job training with other people that had done that work for a long time. And so started to do that, did that for a few years. And then I eventually became local president and was on and off the job a lot because of both local business. And then we were doing, which I know we're going to talk about, but a lot of employee involvement and quality of work-like activities. And so it became a problem for me because I felt like I never got very proficient at doing that. And also for the employer, because they would get frustrated because I would be there one day and gone the next. And often in cable maintenance, the jobs would be multiple days. And so I wouldn't be able to finish. They'd have to send somebody else in there. So ultimately, what we did after a period of time was they would just have me do, I sort of went back to my roots, if you will. I did residential installation and repair again. I knew how to do that. I could finish the job and not leave them in a lurch.
Anything else? We're going to move on to your union work, but anything else you want to add about your work for the phone company?
No, I think it was, you know, in retrospect and looking back, it was exciting to be there during that transition, especially being a woman and having a woman move into so many of those non-traditional kinds of jobs. So I'm glad I got to experience that.
You know, I'm going to ask a question I've never asked before. The consent decree, I believe, required goals and timetables for about 5 years, so through the end of the 70s. You stayed on in the tech job through the early 80s.
Yeah.
Was there a drop off in the hiring of women after the mandates?
You know, I don't know statistically the numbers. It does seem like women continue to be hired. I don't know what it looks like today. The job has changed so much. There's been so much downsizing. So my guess is that could have changed. But there was a period of time where there was quite a few women that were hired into what had been traditionally male jobs.
And it sounds like your experience was pretty good.
Yeah, overall it was good.
Okay, let's go on to union then. So you hired into a workplace that already had a union.
Yes.
How did you get involved in the union?
First I was a summer hire, and then I got loaned to another small town called Klamath Falls. And then when they hired me permanently or offered me a permanent job, I moved to another small town called Medford. And so I was working outside. The local president of the local union there worked also out of that garage. So I started going to local union meetings there. And like a lot of small locals, it operates primarily on volunteers. There aren't really paid positions. And so after not too long, there was an opening, they needed someone to fill an officer position for secretary. So basically they asked me if I would be interested in doing it. There wasn't like a big stampede at the door of people that wanted it. And I said yes. And so that's how I got involved. I got in sort of a different way. I wasn't like a steward first or anything like that. I started out as a local officer.
And it was secretary, not secretary treasurer?
No, it was, every local's different. Sometimes it's separate, sometimes it's together. So this was just secretary.
And was secretary typically a woman?
I would say most of the time, yes, it was typically a woman.
Okay, so what local was that and what year?
7908. And then it changed. I'm sorry, it was 9208 at first, pre-divestiture. Afterwards, it was 7908. And that would have been from like 1977 to 1980 or 81. And then I transferred to another town.
And a different local?
Yes. Yeah.
Which local was that and what town?
It was Salem, Oregon. Mm-hmm. And it was 9204. And then the local became 7904 after divestiture.
It was 9204, so
yeah.
It was in a different district?
Yeah, because Oregon and Washington were part of the old District 9. So pre-divestiture, which then the union also reorganized itself, that Oregon and Washington had been part of a district with Northern California and Oregon and Washington. It was District 9. And then District 11 was, I think it was 11, was Southern California. So when they restructured, Northern California and Southern California were put together and became District 9. And then those of us that in Oregon and Washington that were had been in 9 became then part of the new District 7, which included people that had been in, well, geographically the old Mountain Belt and old Northwestern Belt. So it had 14 states in it. So it was the biggest geographically, but probably not the smallest, but close to the smallest people-wise.
Do you remember what year that was?
That would have been right after divestiture. So
84, 85?
Yeah, 86 maybe. Oh.
Okay. So then in that local, did you get an officer position?
Which one? The second one?
Yes, in Salem.
So ironically, the same thing sort of happened again. So I transferred. I'd gotten married, and we moved to a different town, so I transferred to Salem as a business installer. The president of the local was on my crew. Their secretary had left for some reason. They knew that I had been, because I'd met many of them before in union meetings. So they asked me if I would fill in for the rest of the term, and I did.
And then when did you become president? I'm assuming in the same local.
Yes. So I was, I filled out that term, and then I was secretary. So I became local president in 1985.
How many people were in your local then?
Oh, I'm going to guess maybe 400.
And mostly techs?
We'd had a business office that was an AT&T business office, but it only lasted about a year after divestiture. And I think we had a repair center. I don't think we had any operators left by then. So some inside people, repair. There was a pretty good size repair center there.
Repair center means taking the calls for repair.
Yes, yes.
Okay. And the business office refers to customer service.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. So what were, and you were local president for how many years until when?
5. Okay. Until I went on staff.
Okay. So what would you like to talk about that was major things that you remember of being local president? I think you mentioned you wanted to talk a little bit about QWL, quality of work life.
Yeah, so besides being a local president and the regular duties with that, I had the opportunity, the administrative director for the area was, her name was Sue Pisha, and she was a strong supporter and my biggest mentor that I had my whole union career.
Sue eventually became the vice president of District 7.
Yes, she did. And so at that particular point in time, there had been an upswing in initiatives called quality of work life and employee involvement, which it, sort of in an oversimplified way, means that the employer and the union sit down and try and work a lot of issues out together beyond what they would normally do in a regular collective bargaining environment. So there was starting to be lots of restructure and change, which then impacted our members and their employees. So I got to be involved in several of those initiatives. One of the ones that I think was the most successful, they had were doing a lot of restructure in the central office and closing centers, consolidating centers, downsizing as the equipment was updated and switched to more electronic switching. You didn't need as many people to keep the equipment maintained. So lots of changes that impacted a lot of people. So one of the efforts we did is, and there was a joint committee that had both managers and several union representatives on them, and we came up with the idea of doing a training expo in each of as many towns as we could do, and that would have would be like an event, and it would have representatives from schools in the area, information from internal to the employer that would help people if they were in a situation where they would need to either look for a different job within the company, or if they, what was available and what options were available for them to move into a different career totally. We ended up doing like, I think, over 25 of them. So in most of the, a good share of the places where we had people, we even went to a lot of the smaller places. And it was called OPEX, O-P-E-X. And so.
Opportunity Expo.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And then the other thing that I was, had the opportunity to be involved in is when we started combining the contracts, which was in 1989. I was on one of the bargaining committees. There were three different committees, one which was made up of administrative people that was had healthcare issues and things that were across them, and then there was a table that had issues specific on the network side and then one on the marketing side, and I was on the table that was on the marketing side. So going through that was, it was my first bargaining. We didn't have any other contracts in our local, so it was my first time at a bargaining table. So it was quite the experience to go through.
And that was in Denver?
No, we were actually in Minneapolis.
And just for a moment back to the QWL, which first was negotiated in AT&T contract and mm-hmm. the Bell companies in 1980. And my understanding is that it kind of died out in many of the Bell companies and AT&T after a few years, but that US West was one of the areas in which QWL continued. And yeah. Do you know why?
I think it had a fair amount of successes, and the other thing was that there were leaders on both sides that believed in the process and were willing to go to the mat to continue to make it work. When it started winding down several years later, then it started to lose support primarily from within the leadership of the employer. And if you don't have strong support on both sides, it's not going to work.
And what were you able to achieve that you couldn't have achieved through collective bargaining or through other union mechanisms?
You only get to do the big bargaining, you know, every 3 or 4 years. And I think that by having the employee involvement, you got to involve a lot more people. So much more than a bargaining committee. And that we were able to deal with the issues that were sort of in the moment at that time that were going on.
So you had local committees.
Yes.
And the other criticism of QWL is that it saps the militants of the members and creates kind of an illusion of inclusion. How would you respond to that?
I guess I would say that could be somewhat true. I'd have to think about that a little bit, I think. I don't recall seeing that so much. It was more how I would remember it being played out was as the support dwindled, especially from the employer side, is that a sense of frustration at first. So I do think then people turned back to what we traditionally would do, whether it's, you know, trying to bargain harder or mobilization, different mobilization activities.
I'm jumping ahead, but
it's okay.
You had a big district in the West, and US West was a different company. Do you think there was a different culture than you experienced among some of the other districts in CWA?
Oh, there was a big difference of cultures within our district, number one. So you have to remember that we combined, when CWA restructured, it put together part of one district and then two other whole districts. And so the culture that existed and the relationship that existed with the employers was night and day in all of those areas. So in Mountain Bell, it had been very contentious, and their wages tended to be lower, but they had work rules for everything. Northwestern Bell and Pacific Northwestern Bell tended to be a little more similar. They had a better overall working relationship with the employer. Their wages tended to be higher, less working rules in the contract. So when we had to sit down and work to combine those contracts, which happened over a couple rounds of negotiations, some of the biggest struggles we had were not with the employer, but they were among ourselves trying to figure out what we wanted to focus on. So that was just within, you know, our place. And I'm sure that because there were other districts that also got combined in that restructure, my guess is they had some similar challenges. But yeah, I mean, I think that there are cultural differences depending on what part of the country that you're in and how people deal with things. And I mean, some of it being the level of union density, what people are used to, you know, what your neighbors do or don't do or what they believe. So it's very different.
You had right-to-work states, right?
Yes.
Which were those? Before you do, Mountain Bell was what states?
Mountain Bell was Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, Idaho.
What about Montana?
Montana was IBEW.
Oh, okay.
Northwestern Bell was Minnesota, the Dakotas, Iowa, Nebraska. And then the old part of the old nine was Oregon and Washington.
Okay, and I now forgot what I was going to ask. In combining the contracts, you said it was quite a challenge, understandable. I think it's a little more straightforward to understand the combining of wages. Do you go up? Do you go down? And who goes up and who goes down? Which maybe you want to mention a little bit about that. But I'm really interested in the work rules. How do you deal with Do you keep them all for everybody, or how do you deal with that?
That was
how
some
did
of,
you deal?
That was, I mean, we often, there were things that we would have huge discussions about. I mean, I remember in the Mountain Bell contract, they had in their language about breaks, and the other two contracts didn't, because it's breaks are by law, right, that you get a break in the morning, a break at night if you're working a full shift. And so I remember that being, it's an example of a big discussion we had. We ended up not having language in there about them, but there was several points like that, that we would have a lot of discussion about and what to do.
I was asking you, which were the right to work states?
Oh boy.
A lot of them, right?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Arizona. Don't hold me totally to these. Mm-hmm. Utah, Idaho, Colorado, I'm not sure. I don't think so. I think the Dakotas were both right to work. Nebraska, I think Iowa. Oregon and Washington weren't. So this
really affected union power. And
yes.
If the company wanted to move work, were they more likely to want to move it to some of the right-to-work states? You can't repair, but you can certainly move the call centers or even operator services.
Ironically, if you look just at numbers from percentage of members and who was a member, I remember that not in every state, but for example, in the Dakotas, their membership percentage was very high. And they were both right-to-work states. And so there was one school of thought was that that people would work harder because you didn't take it for granted.
Harder to get membership.
Yes, yes, because otherwise you don't get any dues and you do lose, you know, some power. Versus if it's in not a right-to-work state, like in Oregon where I came from, you still get those people's dues, whether they're a member or not.
Was there an agency shop throughout this period, or did it come in at some point?
It was always there when I was there, so I don't remember when it would have started.
You mean even in the 70s?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. At least that's my recollection, so now we're going way back.
Yes, we are. Okay, should we go to you moving on to staff?
Sure. So I went on staff in September of 1990, and I was living in Salem, Oregon at the time, and the assignment that I got picked for was in Minneapolis, and I had the locals that I was going to be supporting were in North Dakota and what we called outside the metropolitan area in Minnesota.
And what were some of the things that you recall that you were involved in, especially as on staff before you became an elected leader?
Okay.
Correct? Because when were you elected vice president?
From staff, then I got promoted and I was administrative director and then assistant. And then
when were you promoted then to administrative?
So 1994.
Okay, you were staff. Let's do a little timeline.
Okay.
Staff 1990 to 1994 in Minneapolis.
Yes.
Then 94 you were promoted to administrative
director.
Director, and did you move to Denver?
I did.
Okay. And then what came next?
And then I think 1999 I became assistant to the vice president, still in Denver.
And then when did you become VP?
In 2004, I think.
And that was until?
Until I was elected to executive vice president, and that was in July of 2008.
Okay, executive VP of the National Union.
Yes.
So you moved to D.C. And then you were secretary treasurer of the National Union what years?
From 2011 to 2015.
Okay. So let's go back to and I don't know if you want to mush it together or not, but your time, major things that you remember in the period before you became vice president.
Okay. So when I was in staff, very different job than when I was either administrative director or assistant. Those two were very similar. So I was in the field. I had locals that I supported. My particular assignment, all the locals were away from where my sort of headquarter office was. So I probably traveled 85% of the time. I also had a lot of small contracts with most of them were with small independent telephone companies. And when I say small, it could be 12 people, it could be 25 people. There were sign companies that had 5 or 6 people. So those were contracts that you would have to go out and meet with the people and put together the bargaining proposals and then sit down and bargain with the employer, which was in most cases was typically board members, and then there would be an attorney at the table. So I had the only bargaining experience I'd really had before that was when being on the bargaining team with US West. So this was very different from being on that, where you're a voice in the room versus you're in charge of the negotiations. The contracts were also very different. I mean, they were much smaller. You would tend to go out maybe because a lot of these places were 5 and 6 and 7 hours away driving from where my office was. So you'd go out the night before, meet with the people from the group in like a cafe or a back room of a restaurant. Often most of the people would be there, and that you would meet with them and sort of sort through what you were going to take to the bargaining table. Because these were smaller groups, the relationship they had with the employer was different, and they tended often not to file a lot of grievances. So you had to sort through their complaints and whether it should be handled as a grievance or whether it should be something that should be brought up at the bargaining table. And then often we would go in and meet the next day. And sometimes we'd get done in the morning and the employer would let us meet with the employees and we'd vote on it. And that would be if it was simpler. Most of the time they went pretty well. Most of the relationships with these smaller employees had been there for years and years. While I was there, there was also an organizing drive that happened with New Flyer Bus Company. That was a Canadian company. They actually are still in existence. They've expanded. This was their initial presence in the United States. So I was not directly involved so much in the organizing. That was done out of the local, but I did share the first contract negotiations. That was my first contract. Because the home company was headquartered out of Canada and they were unionized, we'd actually had an opportunity to go visit them. It was never really a question of if you were going to get a first contract. The question was what was going to be in that first contract. So that was quite an experience, being that it was the first time I did a first contract, but also because the workplace was totally different than what my background was. It was a manufacturing facility. And so they built the shells of the buses were put together in Canada, then they would bring them down to the United States and they would do all the finish work in them. So it was quite the process, predominantly male. So yeah, it was interesting, but we were able to successfully get a first contract. And like I said, they're still around today and a very successful company.
And Minnesota, right?
Yeah. The first plant was in Grand Forks, North Dakota. And then they moved, if my history's right, they moved that one across into Crookston, Minnesota. And then they have another plant now in St. Cloud, Minnesota.
And as I recall, then there was a long period in the 2000s in which CWA was attempting to use leverage to try and get neutrality to organize, I believe, in Alabama and maybe elsewhere. I think they finally got it. We can look that up. Yeah. So when you came on staff and now you had to do all of this negotiations, did you get training or was it sink and swim?
So I went to staff school. I went and I got put on staff in September of 1990, and at that particular time, it's changed over the years, but new staff did an organizing assignment, and at that time it was for 3 months, and you were sent to the field and worked with a variety of people. Because sort of the timing, mine ended up being a little bit longer because they didn't want me to necessarily start like in the holidays. So it ended up being like 3.5 months. I know they do it differently nowadays. I would say it was a mixed bag for me. I did not have really any organizing background. So they sort of plunked you out there with not a lot of support.
Where'd you go?
I was in Nebraska at first. And I was supposed to be helping them. We had a group in that were in about 5 states of natural gas workers. And they were trying to organize the clerical, a smaller group. They were spread out all over Nebraska, Iowa, Kansas. So a lot of time in the car was somebody that really wasn't an organizer, was another person from the local. I think I was there about a month and a half, and then the most productive time I would say is then I was in Texas, and I worked with Sandy Rusher.
At Texas State Employees Union.
Yeah, and she did a variety of things, but she was, and I know she's retired now, but she was a great organizer, and so I really got a feel for what campaigns look like, what it took. You know, we'd be up at 5 in the morning leafleting people and doing that. And I was there probably 3 weeks. And then I finished up in New Mexico, which was another sort of less than lackluster experience. It was they were doing getting ready for an election with some state workers in New Mexico.
So you talked about getting training in organizing. What about in bargaining?
So there was staff school then, which was in the spring of in 91. So you went through a variety of things, CWA policies, arbitration training. I remember less about bargaining per se. There must have been something about it, but we were there 2 or 3 weeks and it was decent training, but there's nothing replaces sort of doing it and learning from that.
And did the district have a structure that there was somebody you could consult with as you were?
No.
Okay.
No. I mean,
it was really sink and swim.
It was informal, right? Uh-huh. So Jack Ivory was the other staff rep that was in the Minnesota office. I was lucky that at least there was one other person in the office. That's not the case nowadays because there's been so much downsizing. So at least there was somebody else there. And the other person I would say I used as a resource was the secretary in the office who had been there for probably 20 plus years and knew a lot of these people and of the contracts. And so her name was Diane, and she was a huge help.
Diane who?
Diane Drum.
Okay. You didn't mention grievance handling or arbitrations. Was that not an assignment for staff your district at that time?
I had one arbitration the whole time I was there. I had primarily smaller locals, and they tended not to generate a lot of grievances. So I did have a few grievances, but it wasn't a big part of my assignment. Did a lot of training, stewards training. There had been some organizing drives going on with some cable TV units in Minnesota. So was involved. They weren't successful, but was involved in those.
Okay, so let's move to when you were in Denver.
Okay.
In administrative positions. What were some things that you remember from that period?
So I did do a lot of grievances when I got there to do that. And at that time, we still had, I think, maybe two different contracts. But anyway, the way we structured, there was two administrators. The other one was John Thompson and myself. And so we split up responsibility for grievances between the network side and the marketing side.
And your vice president was Supisha?
Supisha was the vice president, yes. Yes. And a lot of time on that, then a lot of time during doing collective bargaining, getting ready for bargaining, and working on other administrative issues. I think at some point I had my responsibility to manage the clerical in the office, which was another new concept of managing other people. Oh, something that we don't necessarily train people to do, or at least haven't in the past.
So at this point in the early 90s, what's the relationship between CWA and US West?
It was evolving, and at some point, I don't remember exactly the year, Quest bought US West.
Let's not go there yet.
Okay, let's not go there yet. it had continued to evolve. There were things that we got along well with, and some things that were more challenging.
And my understanding is the employee involvement continued.
Yes, there was still quite a bit of employee involvement going on at that time, especially on the marketing or commercial side, primarily because of the leadership within the company on that was really pushing for it and saw some value in it.
And as I understand, they were paying for union people to be trained as facilitators.
Yes, there was a small group of people that did that, yes.
And at least in the early 90s, after President Clinton came in, and this employee involvement was a big part of the push coming from Robert Reich, the Secretary of Labor, etc., that a project between US West and CWA was highlighted even at a national conference.
I don't remember. I would have still been on staff at that time and not in Denver till 94.
Okay. Okay. This was the job redesign in the marketing, but you weren't involved with that. Okay. So while you came out of the tech side, you became the person who was overseeing the issues involved with the customer service reps, commercial marketing.
Yes.
What were some of the issues going on? Was there consolidation going on?
There had been ongoing consolidation. And the other thing is during each round of several rounds of negotiations, the employer had been pushing for some sort of commission plan for the sales representatives. And we had fought that off. And then was it 1994? I don't remember the exact year.
Around then.
They brought to the table another proposal.
This was U.S. West.
This was U.S. West.
And were you the bargaining chair?
No, I was the co-chair.
Mm-hmm.
And they called it the Leverage Compensation Plan. And they were very, I would say, very smart in how they did it. They actually set the base pay for the compensation plan at what the base wage was for the current reps. And then that people could make more than that from there. It would be the... Let's say it was $32,000, which I think was about what it was. That was your 80%. That's what you were guaranteed. And then if you performed at 100% of what your goals were, then you could make another $8,000 a year, up to $40,000. If you exceeded that, you could make even more than that. So it became very hard to walk away from. And it was, as I recall, their number one issue that they were really, really pushing for.
Why?
They wanted people to focus on bringing in more revenue and making more money for the employer, and they thought that that was a good way to do that. And I think, like I said, because I think they were creative in how they did it. It would have been very different if they would have said, okay, your base pay was half of what you're making or two-thirds of what you're making. But the fact that they were doing their own communicating with people and say, you know, listen, you're always going to make at least what you make now, but you also have all of this upside. So we did end up agreeing to that.
Were you able to get any rights to structuring or evaluating the commission plan?
There was a committee that would meet and oversee the results. There was specific provisions of the plan that were negotiated. So within the plan, like how much would be for sales, how much would be for products, how much would be for maybe quality, those kind of things were set by percentages. What was left to the company's discretion was the setting of what the objectives were and what the goals were.
So the union could negotiate that of the goal, X percent should be based on revenue, X percent based on quality measures?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And that was part of the initial plan.
So what happened?
Well,
it controversial?
It was controversial.
Why?
But it was because it was very different. But I think people saw sort of the dollar signs of it all. And so it was like, okay, we're going to give this a shot. So what happened? Well, the first year I called the honeymoon period. And basically because people were making so much more money. And the company really wasn't focused so much on disciplining people that weren't meeting their goals. And the objectives seemed to be reasonable and people had a reasonable opportunity. It's not that some people weren't struggling. There were always people that struggled with those kinds of things. But people did, like I said, make a lot of money. And we could see that because we met with them, I think, every other month or quarterly, and they shared all of the data with us. Once the first year happened or was passed, then the whole issue of what the objectives were started to change. Two things. Number one, the objectives seemed to get harder, so we had less people that were making the upside money or making more. And the second thing is that they started to discipline people more aggressively. And so we had a lot of people that were either being terminated or that were then, or sort of saw the handwriting on the wall, weren't doing well, and were transitioning to other jobs. So as we were preparing for the next round of negotiations, the whole plan itself and how the objectives were set became a big issue.
And what happened?
So when we...
I think we're talking 98, but I'm
yes,
not...
Yes, I think so too. Is that we started out, as you always do, sort of shooting for the moon, and we wanted to obviously help set the objectives, which they were very resistant to. And we kept going back and forth on what kind of verbiage we would use, how that would work. And sort of to make a long story short, the verbiage that we ended up settling on was that they would set reasonable objectives for the plan. We'd made a few other tweaks in it. That was the big thing that we walked away with. We still had the group that met to oversee the plan. So that was then approved and adopted into the new contract. And so then we started sort of monitoring how it was working going forward from there. What happened is we didn't see a lot of change, and that the results that we saw were that there was still a huge amount of people that weren't meeting the objectives, and we gathered more and more data, and then we eventually filed a grievance on the fact that the company wasn't setting reasonable objectives. And the grievance went up through the process, and then ultimately we did a big arbitration case on it.
And what happened?
Well, the arbitration case, I thought we did, I'm biased, I thought we did an excellent job. We had both people that did very well under the plan, that were top performers, that were witnesses, that talked about how they still didn't think that it was reasonable. We had people that struggled. We had a commission expert come in and testify. Of course, I and other people testified. And, you know, the company put on their case. When we got the decision, the arbitrator, when he rendered his opinion, all I can say is it appeared like he got confused in the verbiage of it. And he, on one hand, he agreed with us, but the way that he wrote the change that would happen ended up being harmful to our people. It was elation followed by, oh my gosh, what just happened and how do we deal with that? Because we had put so much work and effort, I mean, hours and hours and hours into this arbitration. And I think the arbitration lasted over a week. So we ended up having to get the arbitrator back in, and he mediated, if you will, tried to mediate a solution, which still was never as good as if we would have won it outright. So it was heartbreaking, to say the least, that it ended up the way that they did. I'm not sure where it's at today. I know they did many changes over the course of after I was gone. That's been quite a few years ago now. So I don't even know if there's business offices left. There's been so much downsizing in that. It's sad because I think that it could have worked if the company wouldn't have gotten so greedy.
It meaning the commission plan.
The commission plan, yeah.
But being greedy,
yes,
is maybe in the nature of the beast. And the company changed.
Yes.
And
yes.
You alluded to that earlier.
Yes. So in the early 2000s, Quest, which was basically like a holding company run by Joe Nocio and what was his name? Philip. He owned railroad tracks.
Anyway. Angeles.
Yeah. Anyway, Philip. they bought U.S. West. And so the culture changed. Now, they actually, when they first came in, they acted like they wanted to have a really good relationship with us. So we actually were able to negotiate a really lucrative extension, separate from the whole leverage compensation plan, but with good wages and everything. Then they became more difficult to work with over time.
And in fact, Nacho went to jail, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
What was he doing?
I think it was insider trading. What was it? I don't remember. I don't remember.
But the pressures were intense.
Yes.
And as I recall, let's go back to the 90s. First of all, just one last point about the comp plan.
Yeah.
In addition to it meaning that people were getting fired for not meeting their quota, which is ironic because a commission plan, the idea is if you don't sell, you don't make the money.
Right.
But what did it have to do on the stress levels for the service reps?
Oh,
what impact?
It was huge. I mean, which was part of the testimony that we gave at the arbitration. So people were getting fired. A lot of people voluntarily that had the opportunity transferred to other jobs as they were doing it. So they lost a lot of people. One of the arguments that we continually made when we would meet with them as they were to talk about these objectives was that the amount of money that they were investing in training people over and over and over and over again, because the training that they went through was many weeks long. So they were investing all of this money. So let's say you had someone that was consistently at 90% of the objective. It's not like they weren't bringing any money in for the employer. And so you let them go, and then you hire someone who's not ready to be on the desk for, let's say, 8 weeks, and then they have to ramp up, and maybe they don't even do as good. But it's like no argument would be they wanted everyone to make the objective.
You talked about when you were a tech, there was a lot of freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're responsible to represent the service reps working in the call centers.
Right.
How would you contrast that level of freedom?
Oh, it's like night and day. I mean, number one, not just the work environment versus you're in a vehicle, you're driving around from job to job, you're talking to customers, nobody's listening to you. Two, the fact that you're in an office, you're at a desk, you have a schedule. One of the things you're measured on is adherence. So, you know, you need to take your break at the right time. You need to ask to use the restroom. They're keeping track of how many keystrokes you're doing. You often, depending on sort of where you're at in the chain of time, is you have a script that you're supposed to follow, word by word, and that you have to offer this product and that product. And so the amount of and then all of the regulations that, depending on what state you're in, that have to be followed and that you have to state and restate to customers. So it's a night and day difference.
Okay. I'm wrapping my head around where we are now.
Can we take just maybe
a break?
Yes.
Great.
You're on.
While you were vice in the district office, there were a few strikes. Do you want to talk about them?
Yeah, I mean, there was, I don't remember anything particularly earth-shattering about them. I mean, the ending of the strike that was it U.S. West or Quest at the time, was more CWA internal politics than the strike was. So our Vice President Supisha was running against Larry Cohen for executive vice president at the time.
Right,
so
when you were on strike.
There was, I think, a lot of pressure, that she felt a lot of pressure to get the strike. The strike had been going on. Convention was happening where the elections were going to happen. And so she had stayed behind, but the election was going to happen. So we ended up settling, as I recall, like the day before the election was going on. So,
do you remember what it was about, what main issues were?
I don't remember.
Okay. And the last thing I wanted to just ask about is, U.S. West is preparing to be sold and bought by Quest. What's happening to the investments and the network?
I think like a lot of other companies, whether they're being sold or not, their investment in the plant continued to decline. I think there was some thought that, which Quest was a big fiber company, that would replace it. But there was still a lot of people that were relying on landlines, and that was serviced by cable that had been hung up years ago or had been replaced temporarily. And so they weren't doing the things that they needed to do to keep that service quality like it had been in the past.
So you were in the district, in the local and then the district, during a very tumultuous time post-divestiture. How would you describe how the industry changed and then how the union at the local and district level might have changed?
Oh, my. Yeah, I mean, the change was huge across the industry. I mean, besides the restructure and the breaking up of AT&T and the different pieces that happened, then I think that really started this chain of events of restructure, reengineering, downsizing, resizing, right sizing. I mean, they called it different things, but it really was. And then you overlay that with all of the technology changes that were going on at the same time. So, and in different ways. So one is how service would be delivered to the employer. So we'd mentioned earlier about the central offices. And so they had been where there were old switches and they went to electronic switching. So it doesn't require the same kind of manpower to do it. And then just the technology on how call centers could be structured. And so it used to be back when I first started that every town of, I mean, the town that I worked in was probably 12,000 people. They had operators, they had service reps, they had a repair center, that assignment, test board. So everything pretty much was there and serviced. Well, then over time, because of technology, they could consolidate and have calls taken from a centralized location. So, you know, over a multitude of years, we saw many, many changes where those local jobs in a lot of small areas went away. So, and then that causes, then when divestiture happened, then the union itself also restructured as far as geography and creating what the districts were. But then it also drives what difference things you need to focus on when you bargain contracts. So how do you deal with, so the whole sort of concept of employment security language and what did that mean and how much time people would get notice for layoff, what kind of severance pay would they get, you know, would they get priority placement for other jobs? I don't think any of those kinds of things had been in there in the past, but because of what was happening, you had to think totally differently.
If I'm correct, I remember that you all had to deal with outsourcing of operator services. And what was your response to that? What did you negotiate?
We had a second tier contract. It was called Agent Services. And yeah, it was done because operators had continually were going away and they were outsourcing them. And the company proposed creating a second tier, if you, a lower, let's call it what it is, a lower tier pay, which was in place for several years. So I think, you know, one can argue whether that makes sense to do or not. There's a school of thought that it created pretty continued employment for a lot of people, and otherwise we probably wouldn't have none of those jobs much sooner than we did. Others is you should have just continued to fight the good fight, if you will, and let the chips fall where they may.
And one last thing. There was a lot of consolidation of the service reps.
Yes.
Into, as I recall, about 10 areas. How did that shift? You now had larger locals in those areas with larger numbers of service reps. How did that shift priorities for the bargaining? Or the power within the...
So, if my memory serves me correctly, we had about maybe 50 locals in with varying sizes within the 50 to 60. And so, like you said, is where it used to be that many of those locals had all the different employees that work there. Then over time, that dramatically changed. And so, especially for business offices or repair centers, there were fewer and fewer locals that had them. So yeah, I think that there was some change in the dynamic, and you had to pay attention to that when you were putting together bargaining proposals. So it couldn't be just a pure sort of raw numbers kind of thing, because every one of those locals had technicians, outside technicians, but fewer of them had, as you pointed out, service reps or repair service people. So you had to sort of look at, balance that and look at where the proposals came from.
Okay, let's move on to you get elected to be executive vice president. You said that was in 2008 and secretary treasurer 2011. So we've got until 2015. So we got a 7-year period when you are at headquarters.
Right.
I believe that's the whole time when Larry Cohen was president.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. So you said there were a number of things you wanted to talk about that you thought were your major accomplishments. And why don't we focus on those?
Sure. So I think one of the first ones was that happened early on, so it would have been when I was still EVP, and it was around our work when Obama had been elected. So he had just... he was elected right after I got to D.C. and then sworn in 2009. But his big push was for healthcare reform, which CWA had always been very much supportive of, and not only within contracts and working with employers, but also legislatively. So I was one of the people that worked with Louise Novotny out of the research department, and we had worked on sort of how we would frame up our work on healthcare. And because it was purely legislative on that part, one of the things that came was had many moving parts, but the one I wanted to focus on is that one of the things that we were proposed creating was a more permanent structure within the locals to do legislative and political work. So in the past, typically what happened when election season would come along, you'd scramble to put together your people and committees and figuring out who was going to do what work, and you would, which would then, that's a fair amount of work at the beginning of every process, which took away from the time that you had to do the work. So one of the things that we talked about doing was that we would create a more permanent structure within the locals, calling them Legislative Political Action Teams, or LPATs, and that it would be a more permanent part of the union structure. So you could do ongoing training with these people, not that there wouldn't be turnover with them, but that they would be ready and engaged and able to do things, not just on election time, but post-election if you're lobbying for certain things. And so we did a lot. We identified people, we proposed, we did training. And I think one of the things I'm most proud of is looking back, and I've been gone 8.5 years now, is the legislative political action teams are still in place. So that tells me the idea had merit, it worked. Not that I'm sure that it's evolved and changed and become even better and stronger, but it was very exciting to be involved in something that became part of the union structure.
Absolutely. And this was changing the political work from we're giving checks to people power?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. We still part of, because part of it was, part of the process was also continuing to increase the amount of money that we would earn through for political action funds. So that wasn't like that totally didn't go away, but it really was about creating people that would be boots on the ground, if you will, whether it was canvassing for people when they're being elected or phone banking, to actually going out and then lobbying people once they're in office.
So there would be a local structure, a district structure, yeah, that oversaw that, and then the national,
yeah,
structure.
Yeah.
And building it around the issue of healthcare,
right,
helped make this real and gave them a real source,
right,
of action. And CWA had been involved in healthcare reform or or was committed at making it a major policy issue because, fill in the blank.
Because it had become such a big issue at the bargaining table for us. So I know it really started when, about the time frame when I first was involved in bargaining back in the 80s, was that healthcare costs had continued to increase. And so what the employers wanted to do was to pass that on to the members. And so for our bigger contracts, especially, most of them for many, many years had no premiums. And so there would be no cost, basically, out of their pocket anyway, for the member to have healthcare. And so what we saw is this continued push from the employers to pass the increases on. So most of the contracts, the bigger ones anyway, had joint committees that worked on looking for ways that they could save money without really impacting people like that. But it was getting harder and harder to do that. And I think most contracts now, the employee pays part of the cost.
And part of the sense was our big employers provided good benefits. There were other employers that did not.
Right.
And therefore, we're subsidizing,
yes,
in essence. And CWA was, there was debate between, did you want an employer mandate or healthcare for all, a Canada type program. And
yeah,
where was CWA on that?
Boy, I'm trying to remember. I think it was we wanted it for everyone. We wanted, you know, a single payer system. So
thank you. That's the word.
Single payer system. Mm-hmm. So the other thing that contributed to the success of the program is that we had resources available. So we had starting to have strategic industry funds within the unions, which gave us money then that we could use to do training and support them on an ongoing basis. So that made a huge difference also.
When we interviewed Larry, he talked about the strategic industry fund, but mm-hmm, can you explain briefly what that was and why?
So there was lots of work to be done and not enough money in the general fund to do it. So there was a huge push then to divert some of the money that had gone into part of the strike fund for years, and to look at trying to use it more proactively instead of reactively. It was very, very controversial, lots and lots of debate, but over time and at conventions, and it's continued to evolve how it's been used and where the money has come from. I know even since I've been gone, it's continued to change, but we were able to get there, and it created a nice pot of money that we could do some of these strategic initiatives that we wouldn't have had the dollars to do otherwise, because the general fund was done to run the union as it was.
The general fund was basically funded through dues money.
Yes.
And while different bargaining units had different structures, the basic concept was what percent of pay went into dues.
Was two hours of pay a month, and then there was another quarter hour that went to, now you're really testing my memory here, quarter hour that went into the defense fund, I think. Anyway, it took part of that.
Right.
I'd have to go back and refresh my memory on that. But
that's that. I know different unions have different mechanisms,
yes,
but that was, so there was a different assessment imposed at one point by the convention to fund the defense fund or the strike fund.
Yes.
And that continued to grow because there weren't that many strikes. And when CWA looked at how can we increase our resources when the national leadership, one option could have been to raise dues.
Right.
And at a time when probably the locals were having more and more needs.
Yes.
And so the idea was, let's not have such a huge strike fund that isn't being tapped into. And what I hear you saying is our healthcare policy work was one of the projects that was funded.
Yes.
And the funding went to hire people who were...
We did a variety of things with it. I think we used some consultants. We'd pull people off work to do training, so it was the lost wages for that.
So let me stop you there. In building the LPATs,
mm-hmm.
Was it all at the local level and the district level, was it all just volunteer time, or did we pull people off the job and pay them the lost wages?
No, we pulled people off and paid them lost wages.
Okay. And that's something that CWA was able to do because the employers would pay the health care, continue for the big employers, and people had their jobs back when they went back.
Yeah, right? Well, in some cases, it was more incidental time. It wasn't like that they were off full time. So it sort of depended on how big the area was, what the area of responsibility was. So that could have evolved over time. As I remember at the beginning, it was more incidental. So we weren't pulling people off full time at that point. It was more, okay, we're going to pull you off to go to training for 3 days, and then you're going to maybe be off during this period of time for 2 days a week or whatever. So, and a lot of the contracts have language in them for incidental union time off, yes.
And in some ways this differs from some other unions' political programs where they hire full-time staff to do the political organizing.
Right.
Okay, LPATs, what else do you want to talk about while you were in national leadership?
So the other two things, quickly, I know we're...
No, you're doing great.
Is one of them was a program called Unity at Mobility. And when I was executive vice president, I had... was allegedly, I can get into that later, the term allegedly later, but... responsibility for telecommunications. And so one of the things that we started, and then I was able to keep the assignment when I went to the Secretary of Treasurer's office, is we started to build, we had a growing group of people within our union that worked at the AT&T mobility stores. And call centers.
And a few techs also.
Yes, yeah. Not many techs at that point of time, but yeah, stores and call centers. And there had been, before that, organizing that had happened, and so they continued to organize them and whatever. But in most cases, these people did not have sort of a working knowledge of the union. In most cases, they were younger. Of course, the whole, we talked about culture earlier, is that less and less out there about unions, probably more today as we sit here with the organizing efforts that have been going on, especially in the service industry. At that time, really nothing. So one of the things we put together on a program called Unity at Mobility was a program to help educate the mobility membership. And so we built a training package. And again, we were able to use the Strategic Industry Fund dollars. And so the big beginning part of the program was around trying to educate a certain percentage of members that worked in the stores and in the call centers. And then the thought would be is that they would be prepared to go back and share that information with the workers. And so to do that, we had put together a whole structure. So we had representatives, in most cases, from most locals that we trained on the training to help that out. It's another program that is still in existence today. There was also a big communication piece. So in general, there was a lot of blast emails and information about unions and different things that would go out to the sort of the masses of AT&T Mobility. The goal was also to get the membership levels up, but it was another thing. It was a lot of younger workers, so another chance to really build the union and help make it stronger over time. And so it was exciting to be part of that process.
Was it successful?
I think it really was successful, yeah. Yeah.
Measured in what way?
The number of people that we trained, the number of people that got involved. I think that if you looked, this is my guess, it had started to change a little bit, but a lot of these people have turned into young leaders and become officers in their locals. So they have gotten to be much more engaged in their locals. So that's one small example. I think we even probably have mobility members that are now that are on staff and that have been engaged that way and become involved.
Was part of what you were also dealing with a challenge that as these new mobility members would come into locals, the local leadership may have incorporated them and may have been felt a little challenged by having.
I think we had some of that go on. Yeah, I think that there were locals that willingly embraced this and were excited about being able to do that and train people, give them more information and knowledge. And there were less that weren't willing to do that. I think we've always had that challenge to a certain degree. It depends on the personality and belief system of the people that are in there. Some people are more open and willing to embrace new people and new ideas and train people, develop new people. They think that that will make the union stronger overall. And some are very territorial and very afraid of that.
And then you said there was a third achievement you want to talk about.
Yeah, what was that?
Next Gen.
Oh, yes. So I was probably less directly involved in this, but actually from the beginning, it was an idea that, at that time, I think we still had annual conventions. Now they're biannual. But I had, just through my work, there was a couple young officers that were at convention, and they had come to me with an idea about wanting to get young people more involved in the union. This sort of gets back to what you were just talking about, is embracing and bringing in new people and new ideas. and so they had wanted to present a resolution. And at our convention, often local people have the opportunity to present the resolutions ahead of time so the committee can do their due diligence on them. But they can also be brought up from the floor. And so they hadn't presented it beforehand. We were in the throes of convention. And so they had wanted, and I thought it was a worthy idea. And so the sort of thought was, well, you either put your thoughts together now and do the legwork to try and get some support when you introduce it on the floor, or you wait another year for it to do it. So they did the legwork. They put together the resolution with their arguments, and they successfully introduced it and then passed it at convention floor.
What was the resolution?
So it was to expand around and involve more next generation and to create a group that would actually, a committee, if you will, that would actually look at issues specific to next generation workers. So I was actually fortunate enough to work on the front end of that, and then it got turned over to some other people over time. But I think it's another entity or group that's still alive and functioning. And it was exciting, again, to see those young workers actually take the initiative to start something from the beginning. Some of the establishment from the headquarters weren't very excited about something coming like that from the floor, but I thought we're a democratic union, and I thought it was indicative of what we should be about. But so it was exciting to see it.
And why did we need that?
I think that there was, as you and your sort of last question talked about people embracing different things, is that there is, at least at the time, in sort of far too many locals, sort of the old guard, if you will, that wouldn't even want to give some of these newer workers a chance or involve them in the union in any way. For whatever reason. I don't know if they were threatened or they didn't want to be bothered by it. But it was a way to acknowledge that we do have we did have, and I think probably still do, a large group of newer workers that have a voice and want to have a say.
It was also my understanding that we were aware of a gap in training the next generation, that there had been a leadership that was older, mm-hmm. and that there wasn't that next generation coming up
yeah.
to take over, so that it wasn't just that we needed to cherish their new or cultivate and incorporate new ideas. It was otherwise there isn't going to be that, particularly that local and middle level
yeah.
leadership, which I think a lot of unions struggled with, because as the union movement declined over this yeah. same period.
No, I was going to say, I think a lot of it is that, and we talked a little bit about that earlier, is in the interview, is the culture changing, and so the lowering of union density. So, like I talked about, when I came in and went to work for the phone company in the 70s, my dad was a Teamster. So I was, even though he wasn't an activist, I was aware of labor unions and what they did, and knew they helped put the food on the table. And now most people don't know about unions. And so how do you fill that gap? And I mean, do you just say, throw your hands up and say, oh, well, then we have a responsibility to try and do something about it.
And you wanted to talk about one of the challenges.
Yeah, so when I was executive vice president, is that one of my responsibilities was to be, I can't remember exactly what the title of it was, but anyway, that there was a telecommunications office per se in headquarters, and that would have a role in it. So AT&T bargaining was about probably a year, the next year after I got there.
Okay, let me just jump in. At this point, AT&T is the company that SBC bought. So now you have bargaining units in what was Southwestern Bell, what was Pacific Bell, what was Ameritech, what was Bell South, what was AT&T Long Lines, Lucent, the manufacturing, and various contracts for mobility. Some were cross-district lines, depending on when those mergers occurred.
Yes.
So we had many different contracts, and within AT&T we had many different contracts with that same company.
Yes, we did. And there were several district vice presidents then. In fact, they were all involved in some way and in one or more of those different entities.
And we no longer even had common expiration.
That really changed the year that I was, quote unquote, had the telecommunications office. So I think the most challenging part was being given this quote-unquote assignment and responsibility, but not really having the authority. So most of the hard decisions, like the expiration dates and working with things, and the bargaining had been going slower. And so Larry, who was president, made a decision to step in and really ran the show with that. But then when all was said and done, then because there was a telecommunications office, the results or the angst about what had happened got laid at my feet, which was...
And what happened was different...
There were different expiration dates.
So some units agreed to a contract while others were still negotiating.
Yes. Yeah.
So that the unified power was broken up.
Right. And some people then felt because we did that we didn't get as strong of contracts overall that we could have gotten. And at that time, mobility wasn't part of that picture that was going on. It was sort of what we would think more of as the core AT&T agreements. So it was more of a frustration around the sort of internal structure and how it all worked out within the union. I think it probably could have been handled a little bit better. And it just ended up being more of a frustration of mine is that I supposedly had this assignment, but really didn't have this assignment. So the lines of responsibility weren't very clear.
Did you want to add anything more to that?
No.
Okay. I think we've come to quite a trajectory. One of the major themes that Jeff and I have been pursuing in this project is the transformation of the union over these 40 years. External changes were, the union was functioning within very big transformations, cultural transformation, economic, industry, market, etc. So I wanted you to kind of give an overview comment about how did the union change over that period? What are some of the big changes that you saw?
Well, I think the structure of the union changed. So just in how we're, how the districts were, the geographical areas were each structured. So that was huge along the way. And, there was a few mergers thrown in there, so bringing other people involved. I don't remember the exact dates, but
do you mean mergers with other unions?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Flight attendants, IUE. So there's all of that that incurred. Then we went from annual to biannual conventions. We really changed how we fund the union work, and we talked a little bit about that with how our dues were structured, and then there was a certain amount for the strike fund and the defense fund, and how those particular funds were then rerouted so we could do more strategic work. That's really changed the work that CWA has done. And I think then another big change is the diversity of the leadership in the union. I mean, if you look at, I remember being in headquarters and looking at old board pictures and stuff from before I was around, and not to pick on old white guys, but it was all old white guys. And now there's a mix of different races, genders, and it's been that way for a long time. And that work was, it didn't just happen by accident. It was another thing that I had the opportunity to be involved in, is there was actually a committee put together to address how we get our leadership to be more diverse. And there ended up being a proposal going to convention, and that was the creation of the at-large diversity members, four of them from different regions. And I mean, that's where Claude came. Claude came on as our current president as an at-large diversity member.
Claude Cummings.
Yes, Claude Cummings. And so those things have created. So there's been a lot of external things that we've had no control of, but I think that overall the union has been very proactive in trying to create a structure and resources so they can be responsive to what's going on in the time frame that they're dealt. And I've been gone 8.5 years, and so I know there's been lots more changes since I left.
When you came on the executive board in 2004, how many women were on the board?
Pat Friend from Flight Attendants, Linda Foley, and I think
from the Guild.
From the Guild.
And Barbara Easterling
Barbara Easterling.
Secretary Treasurer.
And myself.
No other district vice presidents.
Maybe was. No. No other district vice presidents at that time.
What was that?
We didn't have the at-large diversity people then.
Very different.
Yeah.
Any other general comments you want to make?
No, I think I've talked enough.
We could go on for a long time, but I think that you have really summed it up. I guess the last thing, I think you've really summed it up. Thank you.
Yeah.